So I'd like to welcome everyone back to this compassion practice program. And we're into the third session of five sessions in this program. So let's have a look at what we'll be covering this evening. So this third session is titled Empathetic Joy and Equanimity. The first two sessions that we covered last week were covering the loving kindness and compassion practices. This is the last two of the four immeasurables this week. And then next week in the two sessions, we'll be building on these four immeasurables practices with an approach called exchanging self with others, particularly this Tonglen practice. And the recommended reading for this program, The Four Immeasurables and Buddhism with an Attitude, both books from Alan Wallace. Before we go into this evening's topic, let's do a short meditation just to prepare ourselves, prepare our body, prepare the mind, and setting a good motivation. So if you'd like to find nice, comfortable posture, let's begin. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, allow your awareness to descend into the body, right down to the ground, simply becoming aware of the sensations where your body is touching the chair and the floor. And then allow your awareness to rise up and fill the entire space of your body. And simply become aware of sensations throughout the body. And if you notice any areas of tightness or tension in any part of the body, then use the out-breath to relax and release that tightness or tension. Bringing your awareness to the area of your face, and softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face, the mouth and jaw, soft and relaxed, and all the muscles around the eyes, soft and relaxed. And in this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allowing it to flow naturally and effortlessly. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. and simply allowing the mind to come to rest, to come to rest in the present moment. Resting in that stillness. Allowing the mind to remain relaxed, still, and clear. And then setting a positive motivation for attending this session this evening. And try to make your motivation as expansive as possible. And trying to include others in your motivation as well. And then keeping this motivation in mind, we can finish the meditation and begin our discussions together this evening. Let's have a look at what we'll be covering in this session. First, we'll begin with a short review of some of the main points from the earlier two sessions in this program. Then we'll have a look at what is commonly referred to as compassion burnout. And actually come to see it's not technically compassion burnout. And we'll look at that after the review. Then we'll introduce the first of the two topics this evening, that is empathetic joy. And we'll do a guided meditation on cultivating empathetic joy, following which some tips for the practice, the compassion practice. And then we'll look at the second of the two topics, that of equanimity. We'll do a guided meditation on cultivating this equanimity. Then there'll be time for some question answer and we'll finish with dedication. Let's begin with the review. We can talk about two main wings of practice of prajna upaya in Sanskrit. And often these are simply referred to as the two wings of wisdom and compassion. And we saw there earlier that in the Theravada Buddhist traditions at the foundation level, the wisdom wing are cultivating these three insights called the three marks of existence. The compassion wing are cultivating these four qualities called the four immeasurables, which we're looking at as the main topic for this program here. And in the Mahayana Buddhist traditions, then we build on both of those. In terms of the wisdom wing, we're building on the three marks of existence with this wisdom of emptiness. And we're building on these four immeasurables with this aspiration of bodhicitta. And we'll be looking at that in the fourth and fifth session next week. So even though this is a compassion program and we're focusing on the compassion practice here, it's important to understand that that we are to practice these two wings together. That if we only practice one of those two areas, we're going to potentially run into difficulties. And we see this quite often with people who come into a spiritual path, that particularly in a Buddhist spiritual path, there's a lot of emphasis on the wisdom or vipassana practice. So we often find a lot of people putting a lot of effort into vipassana practice, but somehow they tend to neglect the compassion wing of practice. And that means really they're not very grounded. And then often what can happen is we can become very self-absorbed. We can become very disconnected from others. We can even become insensitive to others' sufferings, and in very extreme cases, become completely unethical, thinking that now, because we're some high level of Vipassana meditator, everything I do is with wisdom, so I can do whatever I want. But equally well, we find sometimes people gravitate to the compassion wing, people who tend to be more naturally compassionate, kind and compassionate, put a lot of effort into this, but often neglect the wisdom side of the practice, then they're often not in touch with reality. And then what can often happen is that their compassion can become very biased. I'll help these people because they're nice people, they deserve my help, but these other people over here, these horrible, nasty people, I'm not going to help them. In fact, I hope they suffer. They deserve to suffer because they're horrible, nasty people. So we can become very biased in our compassion practice. And then even with the best motivation in the world, we can often end up doing things that not only don't help others, but actually create more suffering. So we can end up doing unskillful actions through this lack of wisdom of knowing how to help. And then also we can, and we see this often with people who really have a lot of compassion and who want to go out and fix and heal the world. We see this often in aid workers and social workers, full of enthusiasm, full of compassion, go out and try to make a difference in the world, and then often within 3 to 6 months suffer what's often called compassion burnout. And this is a classic example of compassion lacking wisdom. And the wisdom here is the wisdom of knowing what we can do to help, what we can't do to help, and the wisdom of knowing when to rest and to look after ourselves. And we'll look at this topic of compassion burnout shortly to see what that actually technically that's not correct to call this burnout compassion burnout. And then one other case that probably all of us have experienced on many occasions in our life, we try to help others and then they take advantage of us. And then we suffer and we think, oh, this compassion doesn't work, and we give up. Compassion always works. What's not working in this case is a lack of wisdom. Because if we allow people to take advantage of us when we try to help them, then in some ways we're encouraging them to behave badly, and that's not compassion. So the compassionate thing to do is to not tolerate that negative behavior from others. So if we simply add wisdom, then we won't get taken advantage of. So therefore, the importance of practicing both wings, the two main wings of practice, even though here in this program, we are only focusing really on the compassion wing of the practice. And so then in the first three sessions, we're really focusing on these four immeasurables of loving kindness, compassion, and in today's session, empathetic joy and equanimity. And then the last two sessions next week, we'll be focusing on this exchanging self with others, particularly this Tonglen practice, where we build on these four immeasurables as a approach to going towards cultivating this bodhicitta. And then in session one and two, we also looked at how to deal with attachment and deal with anger. And the last session next week, we'll be also looking at how to integrate this compassion training into daily life. And we had for the first two sessions this quote from Shantideva: those desiring to escape from suffering hasten right toward their own misery. And with the very desire for happiness, out of delusion, they destroy their own well-being as if it were our enemy. And it's true, most of us already have a desire for happiness and a desire to be free of suffering, but they're often misdirected. And as Shantideva says, then not only don't we manage to liberate from suffering, we hasten right toward our own misery. And even though we desire happiness, we tend to destroy our own well-being as if it were our enemy. So therefore, if we really want to cultivate loving kindness and compassion, we need to know what is suffering, what are the causes of suffering, how to eliminate those causes, and what is happiness, what are the causes of happiness, and how to cultivate those causes. And when we saw that in loving kindness is defined as the wish or aspiration for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. Therefore, if we want to cultivate this loving kindness towards ourselves and others, we need to know those three things. What is happiness? What are the causes of happiness? And how do we cultivate those causes? And there we saw that we can talk about two types of happiness, temporal happiness, or in other words, our pleasurable experiences, or genuine happiness, this state of inner well-being. And it's when we're cultivating loving kindness that we're mainly focusing on that state of inner well-being, genuine happiness. How do we achieve that? What are the causes of genuine happiness? And we saw there that in all Buddhist traditions, we can talk about the three higher trainings, the three main causes for genuine happiness, and that is ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So therefore, on the basis of an ethical lifestyle, avoiding harm to others, we engage in the concentration or shamatha practice to develop single point of concentration. On that basis, we engage in the wisdom or vipassana practice to gain an insight into the nature of reality and thereby overcome all of our mental afflictions and suffering and achieve that state of genuine happiness or inner well-being. And similarly with compassion, we saw that like loving kindness, it's not an emotion, it's an aspiration or it's a wish. Aspiration or wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. And so therefore, again, if we want to cultivate compassion for ourselves and others, we need to know what is suffering, what are the causes of suffering, how do we eliminate those causes? If we don't know those three things, then compassion is just words with no meaning. And here we saw that when we talk about suffering, we're talking more, much broader than simply unpleasant, painful experiences. Yes, we want to be free of unpleasant, painful, physical, mental experiences. But here in compassion, we're going much further than that. Because we also talked about this suffering of change, which is talking about our pleasant experiences. And we all often have a lot of craving and attachment for those, which just causes a lot of suffering. So we want to be free of that craving and attachment to our pleasant experiences. But even at a deeper level, we want to be free of what's called this all-pervasive dukkha that we find, this state we find ourselves in. And that is that there's always a potential for suffering to arise in our life. We want to be free of that. Why is that potential there? From a Buddhist perspective, it's because our mind is contaminated with mental afflictions. As long as we have craving, attachment, anger, jealousy, fear, anxiety, and so forth in our mind, there's always a potential for suffering to arise in our life. That is the deepest level of compassion. We want to be free of that. To be free of that, we have to be free of the cause. Why are we stuck in that state? And it's because of our mental afflictions. And here we condensed all of those mental afflictions into the three main mental afflictions called the three poisons that poison our mind. Ignorance being our distorted view of reality. That leads to attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things, and then a whole mess starts from there. How do we eliminate those mental afflictions, the causes of suffering? And so here we have that quote from Nagarjuna, the great second century Indian Buddhist master. And he says, by extinguishing actions and mental afflictions, there is liberation. So by eliminating these mental afflictions, we're liberated. And he says, actions and mental afflictions arise from misconceptions. The misconceptions are grasping onto things as inherently attractive or inherently unattractive. And those misconceptions arise from elaborations. Elaborations is our distorted view of reality, grasping onto things existing independently. So by grasping onto things existing independently, we end up with attachment to pleasant things because they seem to be the source of our happiness, aversion to unpleasant things because they seem to be the source of our suffering. The whole mess starts from there. So therefore, elaborations or our distorted view of reality will cease through cultivating emptiness. Emptiness being the vipassana practice in the Mahayana Buddhist traditions. So this is how we eliminate suffering and its causes. We know this, then we can really authentically cultivate compassion for ourselves and others. And in terms of cultivating loving kindness and compassion, it's recommended to do this in stages. That first, particularly for us in the modern world, we start by cultivating loving kindness and compassion for ourselves first, then move out to friends, most easy, then to strangers, so then move out to difficult people, and then towards all living beings. All living beings is immeasurable loving kindness and compassion, meaning all living beings. And then in the context of those two first sessions, we also looked at anger and attachment and what they are and how to deal with them. Attachment, we saw there, was defined as a mental factor that sees its object as attractive, It exaggerates the object's attractiveness and thus wishes to possess and hold the object. Why? Because attachment sees or believes that object is a source of our happiness. And so we are to let go of attachment. But letting go of attachment doesn't mean we become detached from everything. Actually, these are the two extremes. Attachment and detachment are the two extremes that we oscillate between. And both of those arise due to this distorted view of reality, believing the source of happiness and suffering is out there in the world. That the source of happiness is out there in the world, attachment. The source of suffering is out there, detachment. We cut from things because they seem to be the source of our suffering. So the middle way, how to let go of attachment, is non-attachment, meaning fully engaging in our experience without attachment, without aversion. And we looked at attachment in terms of dispelling some misconceptions. Common misconception is that we need attachment to enjoy things. Otherwise, our life is going to be very boring. We saw there, in fact, that actually attachment interferes with our enjoyment of the simple pleasures in life. And by letting go of it, we can actually enjoy things much more fully. Similarly, with a relationship, it seems like we need attachment to have a relationship, but actually attachment interferes with our relationships. That in all our relationships, there are two dynamics, attachment and loving kindness. And attachment is all about me. And it sees the other person as an object to satisfy me. So if we can reduce our attachment in a relationship and increase loving kindness, then actually our relationships will improve. And similarly, to be creative, if we can reduce and eliminate mental afflictions like craving and attachment, we'll open up a space where creativity, which comes from a deeper level of our mind, can more easily emerge. So actually, we'll become more creative if we eliminate or reduce and eliminate attachment. And similarly with anger, we saw that like attachment, anger exaggerates and distorts. In fact, anger sees the object as unattractive. It exaggerates the object's unattractiveness and thus wishes to harm the object. Why? Because anger believes that object is a source of our suffering. And we also there dispelled some misconceptions that often sometimes people feel like, yes, anger is quite harmful, but actually sometimes I need anger. I need anger to be forceful in difficult situations. And we saw there that actually anger exaggerates and distorts. And then if we know from our own experience, if we have very strong anger, not only doesn't it help to deal with difficult situations, we often overreact or react inappropriately and the situation gets out of control. So the answer from a Buddhist perspective is instead of anger, practice patience. And then people think, oh, that means sit there and do nothing. This is not patience. Patience is an undisturbed mind in the face of a difficult situation. So what Buddhism is saying when Buddhism says to practice patience is simply remain calm when you're faced with a difficult situation. Then you can better and more clearly, accurately evaluate what the situation is and better chance of responding in a better way. But sometimes we might need to be forceful in our response. How can we do that? With compassion. So actually, compassion is a sign of strength. Because sometimes people feel anger is strength, compassion is a sign of weakness. Because people sometimes mistakenly think to be compassionate with others, we sit there, smile and say nice things to people. This is not compassion. The compassion is the wish for them to be free of suffering and its causes, which means if they're behaving badly, the compassionate thing to do is not allow that negative behavior. And if necessary, use physical force to restrain that person. And we saw here this idea of cognitive fusion, that why we tend to get angry with others who behave badly is we do the cognitive fusion. Also, why we tend to suffer a lot of low self-esteem and self-hatred in the modern world, cognitive fusion. And that's where we're wrongly identifying person with behavior. And I'd like to just go through that again, because I think this is very important and can be very helpful to help us to overcome anger, to overcome low self-esteem, to really start to cultivate compassion for those people who behave badly, for the difficult people. And so we saw there that if someone's behaving badly, the correct perspective is simply acknowledging there is a person engaging in a harmful behavior. But often our perspective is instead, there is a bad person. What we've done there is we've fused the person and the behavior together and made them one thing. This is a false, invalid perspective. This is called cognitive fusion in psychology. And if we do this, we're in trouble because in any situation, we've got two choices, accept or reject. But if someone's behaving badly, we tend to reject. But then if we do cognitive fusion, reject translates into rejecting the person. Because actually the thing we don't like is their behavior. But because we've fused behavior to person, we end up directing the rejection directly at the person. We get angry with them. We attack them. We find it difficult to have compassion for them because it seems like then having forgiveness or compassion for them feels like what we're saying is, oh, what you did is okay. It's not okay. And then we end up with a fixed, biased, distorted view of the person. Solution, don't do cognitive fusion. Simply have a correct perspective. There's a person engaging a harmful behavior. Then we can accept the person, i.e. have forgiveness and compassion for the person, and at the same time reject their negative behavior, not tolerate negative behavior, and help them to address that negative behavior. So there's a big difference. If we do cognitive fusion, we tend to judge and attack and criticize people, whereas if we have the correct perspective, then we can have compassion for the person and evaluate the behavior and address the negative behavior if necessary, if they're behaving in a negative way. Similarly, this is why we tend to have low self-esteem and self-hatred is so epidemic in our modern world, is that if we've done a harmful action, the correct perspective is simply acknowledge, I have done this harmful behavior. But in our modern world, we tend to have the other perspective of simply, I'm a bad person. We're fusing ourselves with our behavior. And then we reject ourselves, we judge, we criticize ourselves, we condemn ourselves, we have self-hatred, and therefore we suffer low self-esteem because we have a fixed, biased, distorted view of ourselves. I'm just such a horrible, bad person. And then we feel a lot of guilt because guilt is coming from the cognitive fusion. So the answer to this is simply avoid cognitive fusion because it's a false, invalid perspective. Simply acknowledge, I have done a harmful behavior. We can then accept ourselves, meaning we can have forgiveness and compassion for ourselves, have good self-esteem for ourselves, and at the same time, not tolerate our negative behavior, address our negative behavior, and regret that negative behavior. So that's the difference between regret and guilt. Guilt is completely useless because it's coming from a false, invalid perspective. It just makes us feel bad and paralyzes us, and it's not even addressing negative behavior. Whereas regret comes from a correct perspective. Regretting the behavior leads us to overcoming that negative behavior. And so the solution to low self-esteem and self-hatred is not simply to flip to the other extreme, and that is simply reinforce, I'm a good person, I'm a good person. Because if we do think like that, there's very much a danger. We end up with cognitive fusion on the positive, and then it could become an ego trip because we go, oh, actually, I'm a wonderful, but in fact, I'm better than everyone else. And then we sort of discard or don't acknowledge our negative behavior because I'm just such a good person. Everything I do is good. And then we end up with a sort of a conflict because I'm a good person. They're the bad person. Let's get rid of those bad people over there. We're the good people. They're the bad people. Causes conflict and division. Now, if we can't live up to this label, I'm a good person, then we'll just flip back to the other extreme and think, oh, that really confirms I'm really such a horrible, bad person. So the how to overcome low self-esteem and self-hatred is simply avoid cognitive fusion. To acknowledge instead of I'm a bad person, I have done a bad action. Then we can have that still the good self-esteem and at the same time address our negative behavior. So correct view is not to identify with our thoughts, emotions, memories, habits, personalities, and behavior. We identify with these things and then we end up in mental afflictions and suffering. We are not Either we are our thoughts or we have thoughts. Either we are our emotions or we have emotions. Either we are our memories, habits, behavior, personality, or these things are which we have. We have all these things. They are not us. And if we wrongly identify ourselves with any of these things, we're going to have mental afflictions and suffering. More of this comes up in the context of Vipassana practice, in terms of wrongly identifying ourselves as our body and mind. I am the body and the mind. That is the deepest level of cognitive fusion that we do and leads to mental afflictions and suffering. That is addressed in Vipassana practice. And then in terms of dealing with anger and attachment, first, we need a clear understanding of what we mean by anger and attachment. Remember there we saw that how these words are used in psychology is not exactly the same as here in Buddhist context. So we need to understand how they're defined here and how they actually lead to suffering, to develop the aspiration to be free of them. And then the next step is to cultivate this view of genuine happiness, which comes in the preliminary practices within Buddhism, particularly to come to see the preliminary practice, to come to see that there's no genuine happiness to be found out there in the world. The source of genuine happiness is within ourselves. Likewise, the source of suffering is not out there in the world. It lies within our own mind. And then, because if we don't make that shift, then as soon as we see something pleasant, we'll have attachment. See something unpleasant, we'll have aversion, anger. So we need to cultivate that view of genuine happiness to shift our perspective. Then, how to deal with anger, attachment, mental afflictions when they arise. First step, we need mindfulness. We need to become aware of them as soon as they're arising, before they take control of our mind. That's why shamatha practice is so important in this context, is to be able to cultivate mindfulness, to notice these mental afflictions as they're arising before they take control of our mind. Then if we can observe them, we're free of them. They can't do anything. They can't overwhelm us. We don't need to fight with them. They will simply dissipate. And then in addition to using mindfulness to deal with mental afflictions, we can apply antidotes. And we saw there that particularly we can apply antidotes coming from the Vipassana wing of practice, the antidotes such as impermanence and emptiness. By using these antidotes, we can dissipate attachment, anger, jealousy, other mental afflictions. And so this is really a good formula for not only dealing with anger and attachment, but I think all mental afflictions. First, a clear understanding, cultivate that view of genuine happiness using the mindfulness through shamatha and applying antidotes in Vipassana. Very effective. The long-term strategy to overcome all mental afflictions is all mental afflictions come from the distorted view of reality. So to eliminate them fully, we need the Vipassana practice of emptiness. But these are measures that we can use in the short term to deal with them effectively while we're working on the long-term solution of the Vipassana practice of emptiness. Now I'd like to briefly talk about what's commonly referred to as compassion burnout. You know, we go out to try and help and we just burn out. And this is coming from an article called From Empathy to Compassion in a Neuroscience Laboratory. And you can see the URL for that if you want to look it up. But actually, this article is just a part of a chapter from a book from Mathieu Ricard. The book is called Altruism, The Power of Compassion to Change Yourself and the World. And so what is commonly referred to as compassion burnout, technically it's not compassion burnout, because compassion is the wish or aspiration for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. We can't burn out with this aspiration or wish. What is commonly referred to as compassion burnout, as we're going to see in this article here from the book, is actually empathy burnout. So let's see what Mathieu Ricard says. He says, in 2007, along with Tanya Singer, and Tanya Singer is a psychologist and a neuroscientist, I was in Rainer Goebel's neuroscience laboratory in Maastricht as a collaborator and guinea pig in a research program on empathy. Tanya would ask me to give rise to a powerful feeling of empathy by imagining people affected by great suffering. And then he goes on to say, during a pause after a first series of periods of meditation, Tanya asks me, what are you doing? It doesn't look at all like what we usually observe when people feel empathy for someone else's suffering. So when he did his, this, what was asked of him, what was happening in his brain was very different to the normal person who experiences empathy. So let's see what he said. He said, I explained that I had meditated on unconditional compassion, trying to feel a powerful feeling of love and kindness for people who were suffering, but also for all sentient beings. When I engaged in meditation on altruistic love and compassion, Tanya noted that the cerebral networks activated were very different, meaning very different from the ones normally activated when people feel empathy. He says, in particular, the network linked to negative emotions and distress was not activated during meditation on compassion, while cerebral areas traditionally associated with positive emotions, with the feeling of affiliation and maternal love, for instance, were. So we arrived at the idea that burnout was in fact a kind of empathy fatigue and not compassion fatigue. And then he goes on to say the following. These three dimensions, love of the other, empathy, which is resonance with others' suffering, and compassion are naturally linked. When altruistic love encounters suffering, it manifests as compassion. This transformation is triggered by empathy, which alerts us to the fact that the other is suffering. One may say that when altruistic love passes through the prism of empathy, it becomes compassion. The person who feels compassion and kindness can develop the strength of mind and desire to come to the aid of the other. Compassion and altruistic love have a warm, loving, and positive aspect that standalone empathy for the suffering of another, of the other, does not have. And so here then, summarizing, he says the following. So it was clear from my perspective that if there was an empathy fatigue leading to the syndrome of emotional exhaustion, there was no fatigue of love and compassion. Without the support of love and compassion, so this is a very important point here, empathy left to itself is like an electric pump through which no water circulates. It will quickly overheat and burn. So this is what's normally called compassion burnout. It's simply empathy burnout. So empathy should take place within the much vaster space of altruistic love. So remember, for altruistic love, loving kindness and compassion, to cultivate those, we need to know what is suffering and its causes, what is happiness and its causes. In other words, we need wisdom. And so that's what he says now. He says, it is also important to consider the cognitive aspect of compassion. In other words, understanding the different levels of suffering and its manifest and latent causes. We will able thus to place ourselves in the service of others by helping them effectively while still preserving our inner strength, our kindness, and our inner peace. So in summary, if we have simply empathy for others and we're lacking that wisdom, which is manifesting then as loving kindness, then we just end up with empathic distress. We end up with burnout. But if we have that empathy with together with the wisdom in the manifesting as loving kindness, then that will lead to compassion and there will be no burnout. So therefore, this is what is commonly called compassion burnout, actually empathy burnout. Let's now look then at the last two four immeasurables, the two topics, and we'll do meditations on them. The third of the four immeasurables is empathetic joy. In Sanskrit and Pali is mudita, and that is defined as the wish or aspiration for ourselves and others never to be separated from happiness. In other words, it's a rejoicing in our own and others' joys and virtues. This is a focusing on the positive aspects of ourselves and others. This is crucially important in our modern world, where we tend to have this obsessive focus on the negative. So it really helps to provide a balanced view of ourselves and others. And here's a quote I like from a modern day philosopher, William James, who says, for the moment, what we attend to is reality. And what we attend to in the modern world is all the negative stuff in ourselves and others, and generally with cognitive fusion. So that's why we end up with such a distorted, biased, negative view of ourselves and others, low self-esteem and so forth. So therefore, empathetic joy helps to address that balance, to focus on the positive aspects of ourselves and others. But also, as we saw just earlier, not to do that with cognitive fusion, meaning if someone else is engaging in some positive behavior, not to praise the person, but to praise their behavior. Because if we praise the person and say, you're just such a wonderful, great person, it could become just an ego trip. Rather to praise behavior, you did a great action. And that would make them feel good about themselves and at the same time inspire them to continue to engage in that good behavior. But even if you were to say you did a great thing or great action, maybe because they are so caught up in cognitive fusion, even though you said you did a great thing, maybe what they heard or interpreted is, oh, I'm actually a great person. So to even go further than that, to help them avoid the cognitive fusion, even instead of saying you did a great thing, just say that was a great thing that was done. Leave out the you. Less chance they'll do cognitive fusion, more chance they'll just focus on the action. Similarly for ourselves, if we do a good action, we must praise the behavior. Don't praise yourself. Don't say, I'm a wonderful person. Just, it'll be an ego trip. Just say, that's a wonderful thing to do. I'm going to continue to do that. Now, some obstacles to empathetic joy, the far enemy, what's opposite of rejoicing is jealousy, envy. And like anger and attachment, we can deal with that in the same way in terms of mindfulness, view of genuine happiness, and applying antidotes. The near enemy is we're rejoicing in meaningless things. The antidote to that is loving kindness, which is focusing on genuine happiness and its causes. And we'll look at a little bit more about that after the meditation. But that's what I'd like to do now, a meditation, cultivating this empathetic joy, focusing on the positive aspects of ourselves and others. Find a nice, comfortable posture. Let's do that practice. As always, we begin by preparing the body. So establishing a good posture, keeping the back nice and straight, and at the same time, allow the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. And setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Simply allowing it to come to rest in the present moment. Resting in stillness. Empathetic joy is focusing on the positive aspects of ourselves and others. It's a rejoicing in our own and others' virtues and joys and happiness. So first bring to mind a person who you know well, who radiates joy and well-being. And as you focus on this person's joy, open your heart to that joy and take delight in it. And next bring to mind someone for whom something wonderful has happened recently. And recall the delight of this person and share in their joy. And then next bring to mind someone who inspires you with their virtues. Virtues such as generosity, kindness, and wisdom. And rejoice in their virtues. And for all those who are recipients of this virtue. And not forgetting about yourself. You've made the effort to attend this program, wanting to improve and develop yourself. So take joy in this. And now direct your attention back along the timeline of your life to your earliest childhood years. And try to remember the earliest act of kindness you can remember experiencing from another person. And take delight in this person's kindness. And now slowly move your attention along the timeline of your life from this earliest childhood memory, moving slowly through your childhood years, adolescent years, adult years, right up to the present day. And recall all the people who were kind to you, helped you and supported you in your life. And as you breathe out your delight and your gratitude that people have shown you such kindness, that they've brought such kindness to the world. And we can bring the meditation to a close. Some tips for the practice. What we've seen so far in the first three of the four immeasurables, and the same will come in equanimity shortly, is each one has a near enemy, meaning something that looks like that quality, but actually is corrupting or degenerating that quality. And sometimes these near enemies are not so easy to notice. Each one of the four immeasurables has a near enemy, but fortunately, one of the other four immeasurables can act as an antidote to the near enemy. For example, we saw in the first session in this program, loving kindness, the near enemy of attachment is attachment. And so if we see that our loving kindness is simply degenerating into attachment, then that's a good time to cultivate equanimity, because equanimity, which we're going to look at shortly, is the quality of overcoming attachment to friends, aversion to strangers, apathy to strangers. Equanimity, as we're going to see, it also has its own near enemy. Equanimity is this equal, unbiased attitudes towards everyone. But that can degenerate into simply being equally indifferent to everyone. So if we see our equanimity degenerating into simply being equally indifferent to everyone, that's opportunity to cultivate compassion, because it's difficult to remain indifferent to others if they're suffering. We see them suffering. Compassion also has its own near enemy, and that is despair, that we're just simply caught up in a state of despair seeing all that suffering. And we saw there that often that happens due to too much focus on the negative. So an antidote to that is cultivate empathetic joy, to focus on the positive aspects of ourselves and others. Empathetic joy also has a near enemy, is meaningless rejoicing. We just start rejoicing in meaningless things, even to the point of rejoicing in harmful things. So if we see our empathetic joy degenerating into simply meaningless rejoicing, that's a good opportunity to cultivate loving kindness, the wish or aspiration for ourselves and others to have happiness in its causes. Meaning that if we cultivate these four immeasurables as a whole, have an integrated approach, cultivating all four of the four immeasurables, then we'll most likely be able to overcome all of these near enemies simply through the cultivation of the four immeasurables. Also, in general, for practice, we talk about two supports for practice, for wisdom and for compassion for other practices. And in Buddhism, they're often called purification and accumulation. Purification is about reducing negative habits, accumulation, increasing positive habits. And we can do that through the four opponent powers and rejoicing and resolve. So let's have a look at these four opponent powers. So how to reduce negative habits is, if we notice we've done something negative, regret. Remember, don't do the guilt. Guilt is coming from cognitive fusion. Simply acknowledge, I've done a harmful thing, regret the behavior. That will start to overcome that negative habit, negative imprint. Second power is reliance, or sometimes called foundation. This is the foundation, the direction of our life, positive direction of our life. If we've done something harmful, we've fallen down from our foundation. This second power is about picking ourselves back up, reaffirming our positive direction in our life. If you're following Mahayana Buddhism, this would be simply going for refuge and generating bodhicitta. That is our direction in life within the Mahayana Buddhist tradition. Think of a practical remedy is the third point. So if we, for example, verbally abuse someone at work, apologize. And then the fourth thing we can do, resolve, make a strong determination not to repeat that negative behavior again. If it's a strong habit, no point in saying I'm never going to do it again. It won't happen. So if it's a strong habit, give a time limit. For example, I'm not going to do that for the next week. If that's way too difficult for the next day, I'm not going to do it. Way too difficult for the next 10 minutes, I'm not going to do that thing. Pick an amount of time with effort you can normally manage. And then over time, you can slowly expand that limit. And then you can start to even break strong habits. So if we, every time we've noticed we've done something harmful, if we go through these four opponent powers, regret the action, reaffirm our positive direction, apply a remedy, strong determination not to do it again, we'll start to weaken our negative habits. Increasing the positive habits, the accumulation, is to rejoice in the good actions we did and make a strong resolution to continue that good behavior. And so how to do these supports in a practical way is end of day, to do an end of day review before you go to sleep. How did our day go? And pick one negative thing we did during the day and go through these four opponent powers: regret, reliance, remedy, resolve. This is really compassion for ourselves. Equally important, even more important, pick one good thing we did during the day, rejoice in the behavior, resolve to do continue that good behavior. So that's going to be empathetic joy and loving kindness for ourselves. But also, I think we tend to take things for granted in our life. And therefore, another thing to do, pick one thing we received during the day. And we receive a lot of things many times during the day. Pick one thing we received and have a sense of gratitude for having received that thing. So this is also empathetic joy. So this is a practical way I think we can really cover these first three immeasurables as a sort of a day review at the end of the day. Let's go now to the second of the two practices today, equanimity, and then we'll go to meditation. Equanimity in Sanskrit is upeksha, in Pali upekka. Equanimity is the wish or aspiration for ourselves and others to abide in this equanimity, which means to be free of attachment and aversion to those near and far. The long version is to be free of attachment to those close to us, apathy to strangers, aversion to difficult people. So equanimity is this impartial, unbiased attitude towards others. Now we tend to be very biased or partial, and we tend to categorize people into three groups simply from the perspective of how they seem to affect us. Those people around us who seem to support me in my happiness, we tend to label friends. Those people around us who don't seem to interfere with me in my happiness, we tend to label strangers. Those people around us who seem to interfere with me in my happiness and maybe seem to cause me suffering, label the so-called enemy. Then, of course, we end up with attachment to friends because they seem to be the source of our happiness, apathy to strangers because don't care what happens to them, and aversion to difficult people because they seem to be causing us suffering. Equanimity is about overcoming that by understanding we're all equal in wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. We are all in the same situation, and to develop this sense of closeness to everyone. And it's this equanimity that is really the basis for us to be able to cultivate loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy boundlessly towards immeasurable living beings. And as we just saw, the near enemy to equanimity is indifference or apathy. That if we notice our equanimity is simply degenerating into being equally indifferent to everyone, good time to cultivate compassion to avoid that. The far enemy, attachment and aversion. And we've seen how to overcome them through mindfulness, view of genuine happiness, and applying antidotes. So this is the obstacles to equanimity. So let's do that meditation now, and then we'll go to question answer after the meditation. So if you'd like to find a nice, comfortable posture, let's do this practice on cultivating equanimity. Setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. A vigilant posture is to keep the back nice and straight. And at the same time, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed. the breathing flowing naturally and effortlessly. And releasing all activities of the mind, and simply allowing the mind to come to rest in stillness, resting in the present moment. Equanimity is a mind of impartiality towards others. In other words, not having attachment to those close to us, not having aversion or hatred to difficult people, and not being apathetic or indifferent towards strangers. It's equanimity that allows loving kindness and compassion to expand boundlessly. Normally, these qualities are mixed with attachment, but we grow beyond attachment as we realize that every living being is equally worthy of finding happiness and freedom from suffering. Now, first bring to mind a person who you know well, but is neither a friend nor someone who you dislike. And picture them very clearly in front of you. This person is just like yourself, in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. And now shift your perspective and view the world through their eyes. And from this perspective, look back on yourself. Their yearning for happiness and wish to be free of suffering is identical to your own. And even though they're not close to you, their happiness is no less significant than the happiness of a loved one. Next, bring to mind a person who you feel is crucial to your well-being, a person for whom you have both affection and attachment. And again, picture them very clearly in front of you. And again, shift your perspective and view the world through their eyes, being that person from the inside. They have their own hopes, fears, and desires. And now step back and again view this person from the outside. This person is not the true source of your happiness. This can only come from within your own mind. Next bring to mind a difficult person, someone who you dislike. Again, picture them very clearly in front of you. And again, shift your perspective to this person's perspective, being this person from the inside, experiencing their hopes and fears. They're just like yourself in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. And again, step back and view this person from the outside. This person is not the true source of your distress or anxiety. This can only come from within your own mind. And realize there's nothing inherent in the stranger, the loved one, or the difficult person that makes them that way. Circumstances change. And they can easily change from one category to another. Shifting circumstances bring us together and cause us to part. And recognize that every person is fundamentally like yourself. Wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. And so arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if everyone had equanimity, to be free of attachment to friends, to be free of apathy or indifference towards strangers, and to be free of hostility, anger, or hatred toward difficult people. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. To rest in that inner purity of mind. Which is in the nature of equanimity, impartiality. And we can bring the meditation to a close. So we now have some time for question answer. So we've got any questions, Miffy?
There aren't any questions yet in the chat, but I have a couple for you, Glenn.
Sure.
So When you were saying how loving kindness, then when it's triggered by empathy, becomes compassion. So that kind
through of through the prism of empathy, yeah.
Through the so is that why in the sevenfold cause and effect for developing bodhicitta, loving kindness comes first, and then compassion comes after that. Is that part of that natural kind of trajectory?
I mean, possibly because see, also we see that in the Tonglen, it's the reverse, as we're going to see in session five, that first we have to do compassion and then loving kindness. But I think that the natural thing is to reflect on that kindness, but then see that actually people are suffering. We want them to be happy, but we see them suffering. And that empathy with others suffering on the basis of the loving kindness then I think leads to compassion. And certainly in terms of the four immeasurables, that's the order. And so that would sort of make sense.
Yeah, because if you go the other order, compassion first, then it can become a real drudge because there is no foundation, like you said, or a possibility of relief or being able to help.
Mm. Yeah, I think that also, particularly in our modern society, we really have this obsessive focus on the negative. And so I think it's also for that reason, particularly in our modern society, is to focus on the positive aspects. You know, loving kindness is all about striving for genuine happiness. To have that as the starting point, I think makes much more sense also in the modern world.
Yeah. Thank you. Then my other question is, you know, we don't even know the meaning of words in our own language. Like when you were saying, you know, compassion, and we just automatically think it means empathy, whereas actually, you know, it's an aspiration. And then today when you're talking about patience and how I just hear passive. So, you know, do you have any tips for how we can develop some kind of discriminating wisdom so we can actually use our own language correctly?
Well, it's not so much about using our own language correctly. It's the fact that these words in different contexts have different meanings or are used differently. You know, I mean, generally when we speak about love and compassion, they're emotions. And here, when we use, as I said, in Buddhist psychology, we don't really talk about emotions. In fact, I think there is no word in Sanskrit or Tibetan that means emotion. And so in Buddhist psychology, it's what's underlying the emotions that is the key. What's driving the verbal and physical displays of emotions and so forth, that is what is key. Not so much whether we have a very red face and saying lots of loud words or saying nice things or whatever. That's sort of the secondary. The key is what is driving that sort of verbal and physical display. And so this is where the challenge is that that's at the level that we are using these words, and that's not commonly how they are used in the modern world. We talk a lot more about emotions, and love is an emotion, compassion is an emotion, and so forth. And so it's not a matter of, you know, we Buddhists have got it right and everyone else has got it wrong. It's just a matter of understanding the difference in usage. And so the challenge is, though, that, you know, we have to use common terminology. You know, we can't just sort of, sometimes what I see is, to avoid this confusion, sometimes people invent a new word, a translation term, a term that's probably hardly anyone has ever heard of. And then they start throwing this word around and people go, well, what are you talking about? You know? And so, you know, that's also, I think, not a solution. So what I try to do is, what I've been doing in this program and other programs, is try to give the original Sanskrit term as well, like Karuna, Maitri, Metta, and so forth. And then to give a clear definition, you know, a wish or aspiration. And to highlight the fact that in psychology, these terms are not often used in the same way, because we saw with attachment, we saw that attachment in psychology, you know, we talk about attachment theory, where they say that we are, there's, you know, we need to act, there are healthy forms of attachment that we need to actively cultivate. And an example that, that's often given is this strong bond between mother and child. That we need to cultivate that. And of course, Buddhism is not arguing about that. We need to have a not only a strong bond between mother and child, we need to have a strong bond between everybody. So no, there's no argument there. It's just that that is labeled attachment in psychology, where in Buddhism, that's not attachment. Of course, attachment could come into the bond between mother and child, and from a Buddhist perspective, and that would just create problems in that relationship between mother and child. And similarly with anger, as I quoted from that book by the psychologist, where he said, you know, you Buddhists have got it completely wrong. It's not about getting rid of anger. It's about having the right type of anger at the right time in the right amount. Otherwise, how could you deal with social in difficult situations like social injustice? So, you know, it was obvious to me how he was using the word anger was not the way it's being used in Buddhism. Yeah. And so this is the challenge. And I think part a solution could be is if a Sanskrit term becomes more widely used, then just use a Sanskrit term. Like, I think certainly metta is something that is quite, you know, well known now, or even Maitri. And so if they become quite well known, the Sanskrit term, just use that term, then it becomes clear, then there's no confusion about the term. But it's a difficult point, because we have to be able to communicate with other people, and so we have to use, you know, similar terminology, or so we're not sort of talking at the same about the same thing. So it's a challenge that I think there's no easy solution to, apart from just clearly defining how we're using these terms.
Okay. And then, so when you said, you know, there may not even be a word for the emotion within the Buddhist system. So where does fear sit in that? Is that an emotion or a result of an affliction? Or, because, I mean, fear, it's so prevalent in our culture. So where does it fit into the scheme of things in Buddhist psychology?
Well, I think that the sort of the generic, you know, what we saw in this module is that there, I mean, we can talk about many mental afflictions, but we can narrow it down to these three of ignorance, which is the root, which is our distorted view of reality. And then from that, we end up with attachment and aversion. So attachment is the sort of pulling towards, and aversion is the pushing away. So fear would come in the category of aversion. So the aversion would cover mild irritation, frustration, fear, anxiety, hostility, anger, hatred, rage. I mean, these are all various flavors of wanting to be separated. So effectively, because of the distorted view of reality that we see ourselves as independent of what we experience, then the pleasant things we experience, we want to be connected to that. So that's attachment. And that comes in many different flavors as well, you know, craving and all those sort of things. So there's many flavors of that. And then the unpleasant ones that seem to be the source of our suffering is this pushing away. So we have this pulling towards and pushing away. And in I think the fear, anxiety, and all of that comes in that group, in that grouping of aversion, which is the generic pushing away is aversion. And the one in that group that we focus on a lot in Buddhism is anger. And anger, again, is really this intention to harm. And that's very destructive. And so within the group of aversion, we often put the spotlight on anger. And that's why even sometimes in those three poisons, instead of aversion, you'll actually see listed there anger.
Yeah, okay.
And also, often in the Theravada traditions, the underlying root cause is our distorted view of reality, grasping. But in a practical sense, what is really driving our behavior is this attachment. And so often in Theravada traditions, they'll actually say the root underlying mental affliction, the one that's causing the problems, is attachment, because that's really the one that's driving the whole show. But that's coming of, yeah, from the distorted view of reality.
Okay, well, it seems like I was the only one with questions tonight.
Oh, no questions, okay.
No. Well, John had one earlier about, well, what is the difference between compassion burnout and empathy burnout, but then you went into great detail about that, so the questions are done.
Good, okay. Well, then we're just about running out of time, so we'll leave it there. So let's just dedicate again. So I'll get the screen up. Dedicate all of our efforts in this evening session using the Shantideva dedication prayer. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Thank you. So the next session will be next Monday, session 4 of 5, and we'll be looking at this exchanging self with others, where we build on the four immeasurables. And we'll talk a little bit about the bodhicitta and this exchanging self with others being one of the main methods to cultivate the bodhicitta. But we'll be focusing primarily on this exchanging self with others. And then on the Wednesday, session 5, will be within that, we'll be looking at this tonglen, giving and taking practice. So they're the two last sessions we'll have in this compassion practice program next week. Until then, stay safe, stay well, enjoy your weekend. See you next Monday.